It's actually a really interesting magazine. It's published out of Central Eastern Europe. Fairly simple format, fairly sort of ordinary looking magazine. And the theme for the first issue is sharing. And it's fascinating. It's talking about sharing culture under communism, which was driven by the ideologies of that movement, but also by the lack of resources and out of necessity.
Design journalist Katie Tregeddon talks us through a couple of her favourite design-minded magazine and asks why the smaller titles are asking bigger questions of the design world.
The contents page is this beautiful sort of pieced together series of black and white photographs of the street that their office is on. And then they've really dug deep into each of these spaces, both throughout history and also sort of physically. So they've created this incredible montage of photographs and invoices and tickets and things they've found in these buildings that have particular resonance.
We're taking a design-eyed tour of the newsstand today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle's weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. We take the temperature of design publishing with an in-studio reviewer today. Plus,
everything in this world that wasn't made by nature has been designed. And designers need to make thousands of human-centered decisions about the products or the environments that they're designing. The width or length of your phone determines how easy it is to hold, to swipe, or to talk.
Why are long out-of-print design manuals making a comeback? And what's the enduring allure of a tactile product? We ask the publishers behind an intriguing new book. All that coming up right here on Section D on Monocle 24. Now, the digital revolution may have hampered design coverage in the broadsheets and troubled some of the more ubiquitous mastheads around the world, but there's also a flourishing of independent titles. We set design journalist, author and friend of the show, Katie Tregeddon, the enviable task of finding a few envelope-pushing titles from the newsstand to discuss.
I've got a couple of normal-sized magazines, but I also have an absolutely enormous magazine called Buffalo, which quite frankly is ridiculous, but I kind of love it for that reason.
Well, we'll leave people waiting for that, because on top I see a rather colourful number in a kind of turquoise and red. It says issue number one of Cities magazine. Now that sounds suitably specific, but not that exciting. What caught your eye about it?
It's actually a really interesting magazine. It's published out of Central Eastern Europe.
Do you mind if I grab the copy from in front of you?
Grab and flick. Fairly simple format, fairly sort of ordinary looking magazine, but it's published out of Central Eastern Europe, and the theme for the first issue is sharing. And it's fascinating. It's talking about sharing culture under communism, which was driven by the ideologies of that movement, but also by the lack of resources and out of necessity. So this idea that a block of flats might have had one television in the entire block of flats, and so people would have gathered around in the garden to watch a football match. And contrasting that with the new sharing economy, so things like Uber and Airbnb and some sort of communal housing projects that are being developed at the moment to solve the housing crisis, in inverted commas.
An amazing sort of odd link back to, you know, what the world of communism and perhaps, needful sharing and a lack of resources might tell us about the future of our physical and actual cities. I mean, there's something a little bit sobering there, but this is rendered in an extremely positive way, whether it's talking about virtual reality or whether it's talking about shared spaces in cities. And, you know, this is a thing that we'll talk about a little later, and the thread between your magazines. This idea that the design can extend to urbanism, can extend to architecture, and can actually be a real problem solver for the world that we're in, not just a case of adorning things and making them beautiful. Was that one of the thinkings behind grabbing this issue?
Yeah, absolutely. As always, I went into mag culture and asked Jeremy for some advice. And it's interesting, this is a new magazine, and there's a whole crop of relatively recent design magazines that are moving away from what I call the cushions and curtains approach to design, which, as you say, is about adornment, about decoration, and moving towards solving some of the big problems that we're facing as a planet at the moment. And I think design thinking has some really interesting things to bring to some of those problems. And it's interesting to see that independent magazines are now cropping up to talk about some of those things.
And I spy a rather beautiful looking cover in front of me. The sheer face of a sort of glass and steel tower block extending into the distance with a lovely sort of grid that reminds me of sort of school squared paper around it. What's our next magazine?
This is Modernist magazine, so this is a magazine about 20th century design, but eerily prescient. I suspect this went to press before the Grenfell tragedy, but it opens with a big story on the sort of demise of the tower block and how the tower block was once seen as this sort of wonderfully ideological modernist triumph over sort of ordinary people, and now seen as a much more negative thing, and even more so given the light of recent events, which, given that they're not mentioned in there, I suspect happened after this magazine went to press. But there's a lovely photo essay that just depicts tower block after tower block after tower block with very little editorial explanation, just sorts of lets those aging modernist buildings speak for themselves. Quite sobering in the light of recent events.
Completely. And I see, again, the communism isn't going to be the theme of this magazine now, but I see a lot of Cyrillic script on the front of them. And, you know, part of the icon, the idea behind these tower blocks was often getting a lot of people in one place and just sort of sorting them out, getting them a house. But, you know, it does resonate today when we think about density in our cities, doesn't it? And how, you know, how we build livable spaces, which does date back to the modernists. But as you say, in Grenfell becomes a big, big problem. I guess the other thing that this engages with a little bit, being a magazine about modernism that comes out today, is the state of private housing as well as public housing, which Grenfell has sort of missed a little bit in the coverage around it. I think as journalists, we need to talk about public housing and the lack of provision and the unsafeness. But also, we're at a crisis in cities where private housing is built for people who don't even live in those cities. So
yes, and I think the crisis in private housing is putting a lot of pressure on public housing. And the other thing which I think is missed in a lot of contemporary tower blocks is that the modernist ideal of tower blocks meant small living spaces but large communal spaces. So there would be a library, there would be a gymnasium, there would be shared canteens. And particularly in Soviet architecture, there was this idea that if we took kitchens out of homes, women would be freed from sort of domestic slavery. And so there was this idea that a lot of the parts of the home would become more communal and more shared. And I think that brings us onto this idea of public space and private space. And what a lot of contemporary tower blocks lack is genuine shared communal space, so that those tiny flats are just tiny flats.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it does re-engage with this idea that modernism isn't something that belongs in a beautifully shot, beautifully published trope about how nice concrete is and these kind of like otherworldly looking structures. There's an ideal, there's a sense that people need to have certain rights and their living spaces need to empower and embolden them to live nicer lives, and maybe that's something that the modernist can help us think about. So you're two for two. I love the first one. I like the second one even more. What is number three on our roundup of beautiful design magazines that have caught your eye, Katie?
This is actually the Architectural Review, which is a long-standing, very well-respected architecture magazine. But its cover caught my eye, and it's all actually about the theme of home, and that's been explored in different ways. And I think there's a real trend in magazines at the moment to sort of pick a theme and explore that throughout the magazine.
Sorry, knocking your stack over as I grab for the title. A beautiful cover, maybe a slightly unexpected cover. So this looks like a kind of Central Asian homestead with a kind of woman working and a man sort of staring at the camera. What do they talk about? What are the issues of home that are discussed? And actually, as I flick through, I do see the Grenfell tower fire.
Well, interestingly,
early on,
both the first and last story are Grenfell, and they're talking about sort of being very careful to say prior to the outcome of the inquiry it's not possible to apportion blame, but they're sort of looking at this idea of the ambiguity of liability and actually who is responsible for what happens in buildings. Is it the owners? Is it the contractors? Is it the architects? And they also look into something which interested me as a writer, the idea of linguistic dishonesty. So rather than cost-cutting, people now talk about cost control or value engineering. And there's also this idea of risk transfer, otherwise known as passing the buck. So there's quite an interesting conversation there about more broadly who needs to be taking responsibility, not only for fire safety, but for well-being and for the lives that are lived in these buildings that we're creating. So that was a really interesting article. And interestingly, there's another article in there, which is a review of the Japanese house exhibition at the Barbican, which talks about that because Japanese houses, on average, their lifespan is 25 to 30 years. In the UK, the average house's lifespan is 141 years.
And this is because we're more protective, we're slower to move. I think Japanese culture does have a certain knock it down and build it again.
Also, you know, there's earthquakes, there's natural disasters, there's lots of things that have damaged housing. So the Japanese don't have an idea of profit associated to their houses. Actually, if you're going to sell a house, you tend to knock the house down and sell the land because people want new build houses. 87% of home sales are new builds. So it's interesting to see that when you take this idea of investment and profit away from building homes, you can really focus on building homes. And I thought that was quite interesting to have those two articles in juxtaposition in the same magazine.
That was design journalist Katie Tregeddon there talking to me about the cream of the crop in design publishing. We'll be back to leaf through a few more titles in just a moment. But first, a brief glance through the Section D history books. Now, when Vogue magazine published its first issue back in 1892, it was more of a newspaper aimed at New York's upper classes, including, perhaps unexpectedly, a sports section. It was only after the publisher Condé Nast took over the title in the early 1900s that its focus shifted towards its current form and towards its female readers. The fashion journal has put more classic editions to print than perhaps any other magazine, and this year's September issue pays tribute to that rich history, with a cover featuring an original painting by the artist John Curran, which depicts the actress Jennifer Lawrence. The metaphorical Section D mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch with our producer, Ben Rylan. He can be contacted at br@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. At a time when just about everything is accessible online, it's a welcome relief to find that, contrary to popular opinion, interest in printed products is persisting. Joining the ranks of classic publications finding their way back into print are the Human Scale Manuals, a set of three books from the 1970s that decode human anatomy for industrial designers. The manuals have been saved from dusty obscurity thanks to the efforts of Chicago firm IA Collaborative. I spoke to the founder and chief design officer, Dan Kramer, to find out a little bit more.
Human Scale Manuals were created for and really are helpful for anyone looking to design things for people. And whether that thing is a product, a building, an interior, or maybe an exterior space, or even a digital interaction. Its primary users are designers, architects, and engineers, but as we found through the Kickstarter campaign, it also appeals pretty broadly to design enthusiasts and even DIYers who are maybe looking to remodel their home or plan out a new furniture arrangement.
And these things, do they deal with the kind of nitty-gritty of ergonomics, the way that people sit, the way that people stand? Is that the real driving force of them? They're obviously reminders that design should always be kept in context with the people that use it, but they're actually pretty gritty and pretty detailed, these things, aren't they?
Absolutely, and they really need to be detailed, because when you think about it, everything in this world that wasn't made by nature has been designed. And designers need to make thousands of human-centered decisions about the products or the environments that they're designing. So for example, the width or length of your phone determines how easy it is to hold, to swipe, or to talk. You know, the placement of your car's steering wheel, your seat, or the dashboard controls even, can make a two-hour drive pleasant or painful. So that's why Human Scale, over the years that it was made and compiled, includes over 60,000 points of human-centered data all around people's dimensions, their flexibility, how strong they are, the strength of vision even. It even includes standards around sitting and standing at work, space planning, light, color usage, safety, visibility. So to your point, like tons of nitty-gritty details, but all of them, when pulled together, produce a great design.
I wonder if you could take me back to the Henry Dreyfuss Associates and the people behind the original manual. What was specifically informative or interesting about this publication?
Henry Dreyfuss Associates, if we step back, if you haven't heard of them, they are an iconic American design firm. They were founded in the late 20s, and they were in operation all the way through to just a couple of years ago. They were really pioneers of human-centered design, and honestly, that's really what drew I Collaborative and my team of designers to wanting to create this and reissue it, because, you know, that's really an alignment with our philosophy at our company. as pioneers of human-centered design, they were able to create icons of the 20th century America, like the modern telephone for Bell Labs, the ocean superliner for the U.S. Navy, Hoover vacuums, John Deere tractors, even the iconic round thermostat that you see everywhere in America for Honeywell, which bears a striking resemblance to the Nest thermostat, even Polaroid cameras. All these great iconic designs came from HDA, as they became known. Through the process of creating these design icons, they set out to compile essentially what has become an ultimate portfolio of human factors data. In between the mid-70s and early 80s, they pulled these together into three books and nine measurement selectors that is called Human Scale, to provide designers, engineers, and architects with essentially a starting point to design products for people.
And I'm going to seize on one word you said there. You mentioned the word data, and that becomes a lot more synonymous in the minds of the digital generation with, you know, the ease of transferring things using the internet, using computers to calculate things. But your project strikes me as poignant and interesting because of this persistence of print and the idea that, you know, a bound book might be treated differently, the data might be used or absorbed differently, which are obviously design parameters and obviously you have in mind as a designer yourself. What is the importance of print and not having this information appear, say, on a computer as part of an app?
Really, there's a number of reasons, but the printed and illustrative nature of these human scale manuals makes the data really discoverable. And by discoverable, I mean, rather than hunting in what might be a database between a series of drop-down selectors or search queries, the data in this print version is presented adjacent to each other. So, for example, imagine you're a designer and you need to design a chair. So you're going to design a new chair for Monocle. You grab the human scale seat table guide to look up the proper seat height for the average American adult. And because seat height data on the selector is shown right next to data for lumbar, armrest, backrest, or even pressure points, you're now considering multiple human factors well beyond the one data point that you went to discover. So human scale, and it's printed in highly visual form, not only helps designers quickly get the right answers, but importantly, it helps them ask the right questions.
I just want to come on to this particular manual that you've seized on and ask, you know, if it's so imperative to the way that people design and so important to so many amazing products, why do you think it's been out of print for so long? And, you know, what obligation did you have to change all that?
Our understanding is that Human Scale was created really as an internal tool for Henry Dreyfuss Associates, really for use with their own clients and their own projects. And they were never broadly distributed, despite their broad application and appeal. So when HDA was winding down their operations, reissuing Human Scale wasn't top of mind. So really until now, the tools were only available on eBay. And if you do a quick search, you'll find, you know, people asking thousands of dollars for a set, or they're available in museums. So now through our Kickstarter campaign, you know, they're available to everybody.
What are some of the reasons that you think this needs reintroducing? Is there maybe a personal bugbear about the way some pieces of technology or design maybe don't meet our everyday needs and maybe don't serve us in the way that they should? Is this a kind of a coda, a reminder to people that the human is the center of design and it's not about what it looks like or the tactility? Is this sort of a bit of a manifesto for you, I wonder?
It really is. I mean, I mentioned earlier, my company, AI Collaborative, is fundamentally a human-centered design firm. So when we were considering reissuing Human Scale, it was just a natural choice and fit for us. The truth is, so many products today, and there have never been more products put out into the world than there are in 2017, but not all of them are necessarily human-centered or well-designed. And there's a number of reasons for that. Cell phones, some of them are really too large for most hands. Interfaces, sometimes for touch screens, the icons or the things you need to click on are too small. Just fundamental, simple little things that are basic maybe haven't been considered. You know, the form is being guided by the functionality or the human that is going to be using it. And really, fundamentally, if you don't have human-centered data or information, you can't design human-centered products. If you don't have that data, say, from human scale, you really have three choices. You can conduct your own extensive research on basic human factors. You could hunt for the data that you need to find and hope that you find it. Or you could pay a lot for access to databases, but likely multiple databases from multiple sources.
Dan Kramer from the IA Collaborative in Chicago there. This is Section D. Up next, a few more design titles picked by our in-studio reviewer, Katie Trigidden. You know, we're approaching the end of your pile and we have probably the two most disparate titles that you've chosen. One of them looks like a small leaflet akin to the size of the newsletter I get through my door in North London telling me what's going on in the community. I assume it's not that.
It's not. And this is really interesting. I've intentionally left it in its packaging so I can do the big reveal for you. I thought this would be a bit gimmicky. This is actually a normal format magazine, just folded in half.
I see. And it's and emblazoned on the front is The Real Review.
The Real Review. This is issue 4. It's interesting because it fits through a letterbox, but it also makes it very easy to read on the tube. And I thought this might be a bit gimmicky and wouldn't actually work, but I've read this on the tube on the way here and it works brilliantly. It folds up into a vertical half of a magazine, so it's lovely to read. But it's described as a magazine for reading. It's very high on the word count and very low on the image count. And its strapline is what it means to live today. So it's taking what I was saying about design solving real problems to, you know, it's not a design magazine. It's about living and all the issues that affect that.
And I've got to say, I do love this format. It is a little funny design-minded solution to actually the limited space with which most of us read.
Mm.
There's a kind of element of curiosity as you have this folded over. It's quite hard for the readers to imagine, but imagine folding over a magazine, reading it at half size, but being able to peek into the inside of it as well. I'm sure that's part of the intrigue, the little curiosity of knowing how these spreads open up.
And it's sort of like what your dad does with a broadsheet newspaper. Do you know what I mean? It's that idea of just making it a little bit less unwieldy. But often they've put the images in the central sort of piece.
So you can look if you want to, but you can actually read without inhibiting the space of the man drooling on your left elbow on the tube.
Absolutely. And interestingly, despite the fact this is not a design magazine, it's not an architecture magazine, it touches on a lot of the same issues. So there is an article in there about contemporary communal living. So there's a project called The Collective, which has been described as London's most luxurious commune. And the idea is that it's to solve the problem of young people not being able to get onto the housing ladder. And it's a very similar idea that it's got communal spaces, it's got tiny flats. But actually, the journalist who went to stay there to sort of trial it out really seemed to hate it. She said it was sort of, the bedrooms were oppressively tiny. Because it hadn't been set up as part of some sort of ideology, people were fighting. She said she met a guy with two black eyes. There were signs everywhere about not stealing things from the communal kitchen. There was CCTV everywhere. And so it's quite interesting to see that actually architecture alone can't necessarily solve some of these problems, and you need the ideology that goes with it, and you need people to sign up to that.
I love the idea of this story because this company is attempting to make money, as all companies do, but also perhaps to provide an alternative to the expense of housing. And I saw this story a couple of months ago and I tried to send our bad penny of a former producer, Henry Rhys Sheridan, along to do that report and make him live in this space. And while I was doing a bit of the research, there were a couple of funny unintended finds. For instance, that the culture of these places wasn't for people who wanted to live somewhere for a long time, invest and have a footprint in a city. It was basically for kind of horny people that wanted to meet each other. Under 30s, no real commitments. With that levity aside, it does raise a quite serious question about that you mentioned, that architecture alone can't dictate how people live. What was the conclusion of this journalist? That this was a worthwhile experiment in housing, or it was a grotesque failure and we need to think of different ways of designing our cities?
It was interesting. She looked at the finances, if you compare them to renting a flat, stack up. But what she said was this was actually renting a room in a shared house. And if you stack up the finances on that basis, it's an extremely expensive model. And so I think she really felt that it was, you know, people trying to make money and exploit the sort of millennial generation who aren't able to get onto the housing ladder.
And, you know, on that subject, you know, I won't name the company that I'm talking about, but I came across another company that pitched to us recently. And they said, you know, we're offering these amazing deals on houses. They're infill bits of architecture. They're cheaper for this reason. Like you mentioned, there were lots of euphemisms about, you know, what it meant. Actually, these were just tiny, almost inhumanly small Hong Kong coffin-sized flats.
Mm.
And actually there was no real design innovation there, other than the fact that they were nice fittings, nice furnishings, and they were shot well. Smaller spaces in our cities. So we're not quite there with dealing with the problem of housing, particularly
certainly
here
not.
In London. So what do we turn to keep ourselves entertained for a little bit of levity, I wonder? Probably the biggest magazine I've ever seen.
This magazine is frankly ridiculous. You can barely read it sitting in an armchair, let alone reading on a tube. It's the absolute opposite of Real Review, but I kind of love it. It's called Buffalo Magazine, and it's a fashion magazine. And the editorial team set themselves the task of creating an entire magazine without leaving the office, which sounds like lazy journalism, but actually they've done incredibly well by inviting people to them and really digging into the space around them. So their offices are in Hackney.
I think they're journalists for the exact opposite reasons that probably you and I are. Well, surely we're out to see interesting things and go to interesting places. But what have they managed to achieve from their office? I was kind of hoping they would be based in, you know, New York State. I thought this was about Buffalo, but clearly not.
Sadly not. But actually, their argument is that you often, by going out and seeing lots of things, you often miss the beauty of what's under your nose.
Okay.
So the contents page is this beautiful sort of pieced together series of black and white photographs of the street that their office is on. And then they've really dug deep into each of these spaces, both throughout history and also sort of physically. So they've created this incredible montage of photographs and invoices and tickets and things they've found in these buildings that have particular resonance.
Now, before we turn the page on this week's show, a few other stories that have caught our eye this week. Here in London, it's been announced that the 1971-built Welbeck Street car park, close to our studios here in Marylebone, will be demolished to make way for a shiny new hotel by Eric Parry Architects. The brutalist gem of a car park comes complete with concrete crenulations and upturned chevrons that cascade down its exterior like zany chainmail, and it'll be missed. Although cities are rightly questioning the role of cars in our city and their effect on pollution and public transport, parking spaces are in short supply in London, as is decent post-war architecture. Compromise and sometimes conservation, remember, is a two-way street. Next, the dream of a cycle-first city has been thrown into some doubt by the spectacular failure and exorbitant expense of bike lanes in metropolises around the world, many of which are ill-suited to two-wheeled transport. Enter the author and urbanist Stephen Fleming. His theory is that building our everyday movements around bikes rather than vice versa would be the solution. Think docking stations everywhere from bedrooms to boardrooms and inclined ramps leading from front doors directly to food shops, then on to offices. Utopia or dystopia, we'll let you decide. These are just two of the proud panoply of design-minded stories that we tackle in issue 2 of Monocle's summer newspaper. It can be purchased on all good newsstands or from monocle.com. Section D was produced by Ben Ryland and edited by the ever-patient Kieran Banerjee. I'm Josh Fannett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.